Good morning. Thank you for whoever said good morning. I say that every day, and that is the first time someone said good morning back. Thank you.
But maybe they want something.
That's true. So now we'll have a pattern started. We're going to go right in order, except for we'll have Senator Morse up first to talk about Senate Bill 582, and then we'll do 859, and then we'll hear 814 and 815 both at the same time. So I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 582, invite Senator Morse up, and I don't see Rich Linton, who's your partner. He's not here today.
Okay.
You're so alone.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Frank Morse, State Senator, District 8, Albany and Corvallis. What you have, I think, as being handed out are two documents. One is a summary of the testimony that I'd like to share with you today. The other is the markup of a rough draft of a marketing piece that the universities will be using jointly to implement the University Venture Development Fund. And you can see very, I think, just quickly what the intent and how this will be played out by virtue of this this marketing piece. By way of background, Senate Bill 852 is in statute. This is not a new tax credit. This issue was examined in the 05 session. It was passed unanimously in every committee that it was heard in. It was passed unanimously by both the House and the Senate, and it was signed by the governor. There was not one dissenting vote with respect to this tax credit, which is rather unusual, quite unusual, as a matter of fact. I believe the reason, there are two basic reasons why that occurred. One is the crying need that we have to fill that, what is termed by many folks in the financing sector, that valley of death, which is that first stage of financing from an idea, a concept that's taken literally from the bench to a scale up to see if in fact it does work. And that financing is the hardest to get. It's also the riskiest, but it is very difficult to get. That's exactly what this bill addresses, is that first stage of financing for an invention, an idea, a technology that that needs that first boost. What makes this bill, I believe, unique from the standpoint of a tax credit is that as these inventions become commercialized and a revenue stream accrues back to the universities, because we've got an OHSU, as that revenue stream comes back, then the university retires that tax credit by refunding money back to the Treasury to offset that tax credit. So ultimately, in the end, and this is a matter of faith and conviction, that in fact our universities are generating commercially viable inventions that will have an income stream. And in fact, that's been proven already. And it's a growing royalty stream back to the universities. That those funds then will retire the tax effect, the tax credit effect. So it becomes essentially a neutralizing issue over time. The reason that we are back here again in this session is the result of issues that were raised from a technical standpoint of how this bill is applied. We had apparently some uncertainties within the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Justice took a while to process that. So the original bill, Senate Bill 582, addressed those changes. Those changes that subsequently were determined to be not necessary, so those are taken back out of the bill. So what you have in the -2 amendments is, number one, we will be reinstating an emergency clause to expedite the ability of the university system to solicit funds for the 2007 year. The reason that the emergency clause applies is we're not changing the tax credit. This does not have a revenue effect because we're already in statute. It's important that we allow the universities to start this collecting funds, and we just can't wait to go through a long cycle. This has been delayed too long as it is. The second thing is that we wanted to make sure that the fees that were charged by the universities were appropriate, and that's why we put a cap of 3% to manage the funds that the foundations would be collecting. Number three, it would require a detailed annual report to the legislature with respect to the status of the university funds and their repayment to the general fund. This is an accountability piece. When we set policy in motion, we want to make sure it works. And so we have that reporting mechanism coming back. Number four, it explicitly authorizes the affiliated university foundations to manage the funds. Originally, these funds were to be placed in the treasury, in the treasurer's office, but the foundations and we collectively as legislators working on this felt that it was more appropriate for the foundations to because they're raising the funds and they have the mechanism that they actually hold the funds within their foundations. Number four, it explicitly authorizes, Number five, allowing the state treasurer to manage the funds for the regional universities because they do not have large active foundations. So it's better functionally, just administratively, to keep that within the treasurer's office. So number six.
Senator Morse, why the regionals? It just seems like this would be a concept that really wouldn't apply to one of the regional universities just at first blush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a good question. I think if we foreclosed the opportunity for the regionals, OIT, for example, it's a very fine institution. You know, they're in a realm that they may emerge. They may have technology that is emerging. They're probably different than, say, Western. But on the other hand, Western may have issues as well. So I think it was just not wanting to be presuming that our regionals wouldn't have technological and inventions that could, in fact, be commercialized. But the probability is much greater where you have a basic focus on research, mm-hmm. like we do at our three large universities. And number six, it authorizes universities to hold the funds in their affiliated foundations while evaluating promising research projects. Now, the Dash 3 amendments were the first draft that you should discard. The Dash 4 amendments deal with an issue that I would like to present to you for consideration. And that is, we have had a wonderful response from the universities. We've had a wonderful response from prospective donors. It will be easy to raise these funds. And the question, I think, for our consideration as a matter of policy is, would we want this enterprise, this University Venture Development Funds, to be ongoing in the future so that these universities will always have a source of revenue that they can apply to the commercialization of inventions that emerge within those universities? That's the fundamental question. And so what we did, and I quite honestly, personally, I think this would be good policy, but I don't want to do anything or suggest that we do anything as a body that jeopardizes the ability of this original concept to take root and to fulfill its original intention. But what we did for your consideration is prepare an amendment that would allow the funds, as they are invested and then returned back to the treasurer's office, the ability to replenish those funds in the same amount as the income that is coming back. So it's an earned essentially an earned continuation of the tax credit. Once the cap is reached within, say, for example, Oregon State University, they've divided up the $10 million between the OUS institutions. And, for example, at Oregon State, once they've reached that maximum and then they have income coming back, they could replenish that and offer additional tax credits for gifts that come back into the University Venture Development Fund. So it becomes essentially an evergreen rolling source of income. Another way to look at it is we, the state of Oregon, would be granting a credit line for this commercialization activity that would allow them to earn their way into a continuing credit line based on the performance of the University Venture Development Fund. And am I clear, or is it muddy? It allows this concept to have a long-term future, is what it does.
Questions for Senator Morse. You mentioned that donors are interested in utilizing this program, and we did pass a bill 2 years ago that the hope was that folks would be interested. How do we know that there are donors that are interested in utilizing, once we perfect the bill that was passed and take out some of the impediments, that we have folks ready to make a contribution and use the credit?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The indications that I am getting from the foundations, those indications would point clearly to the success of raising monies. And if you look at this concept in this brochure, if you have an $85,000 gift, the credit is $50,000. You can take it yearly over $17,000 over 3 years, 20% of the gift. What is unstated in this concept is that we have engaged the federal government to the tune of 40%, approximately, as a partner in funding this University Venture Development Fund. We didn't ask for it. Existing tax code allows that. So for the donor number two, that donor is receiving a federal charitable deduction. So when you factor this in for high net worth individuals that are targeted for these kinds of donations, you wind up with the potential of nearly over 3 years, the ability to recapture your donation through the tax law. So it makes it very, very attractive to raise funds. And the indications that I have, to get back to your original question, to raise $14 million will not be a problem. That's the indication that I'm getting.
Doc is handing you paper to
okay.
Case studies like that. Doc, do you want to testify?
Yeah, maybe we could do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. Jock Mills, Director of Government Relations for Oregon State University. I provided Senator Morse with a copy of the testimony that we provided to you on February 20th from Mary Ellen McGillin. It's just the copy that we provided, where she went into at length her experiences in terms of trying working with potential donors and the level of interest that they were showing. And so it's already on the record from your February hearing. I just wanted to remind the senator that we've testified to that in the past.
Questions for the panel or Paul in terms of the mechanics of what 583 last session or and then 853 last session, if I'm close.
853, I think
last
session.
Last session. And then
582
this session.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator
Charles. I had a person tell me that it contacted the university with a great idea, okay, and was told that the take, in other words, the amount that the university would expect from the development of the project was about 80%, which would be similar to what a venture capitalist would ask for, the percentage of the unit. if you think about that, products that are gonna move, they're gonna go, would have a potential to yield an enormous amount of money for the university. Do you guys know if that was an accurate number? I mean, has anyone talked about how we will structure this as to what percentage will go back to, in other words, remain in ownership of the university of a great idea? Say, like an outsider brings an idea to the university and said, help me develop this, and we'll partner with you to get this to the market?
Mr. Chair, colleagues, and Senator George, an 80% number sounds really quite high, and I would defer, and I wish we had folks from the licensing technology divisions of our universities to respond to that, but they have licensing agreements of the technologies that emerge, and I don't think it's 80% kinds of royalties, because if that was the case, an idea would never become commercialized. That would be too high a royalty.
My point was,
unless I missed your question.
If it's 50%, there's going to be winners coming out of this. We've already seen it. Yesterday, out here in the Galleria, we had the computer that we talked about, which is that little teaching computer that's going to be all over the world, and the software and everything was done, a good share of it done down at OSU. You look at the commercial potential of that, and I want that in every school, whenever at the hands of every child, as soon as possible, that teaching computer. And so you start to recognize there's just enormous potential for these projects to actually take flight, because we were so impressed with what we saw, you know, down at OSU, and just even with my feeble understanding of what is going on here, to recognize, wow, there's an opportunity there. You know, I could just see this thing generating an enormous portfolio of ownership for the university. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're right on point, Mr. Chair, Senator George. I think you're exactly on point, and that's why we're doing this, is to commercialization of emerging technologies and inventions. Where this will lead us, you know, it will be an interesting journey, but I would be willing to bet that in 5, 6, 7 years, we will see some significant streams of income returned back to the universities as a result of this commercialization, the funding of these commercialization efforts.
I forget what the statistic is at Stanford, but it is amazing the amount of income that they derive back from companies that were commercialized in this 10, 20 years. And this isn't philanthropic. This is direct income that they received back into their institution.
Mm-hmm. And, Mr. Chair, to get back to the Dash 4 amendments, you know, it becomes a policy issue of whether we wish to have this be an ongoing source of revenue once we've capped the amount and the tax effect as they earn additional revenues from these investments. Do we wish that to continue into the future?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the policy question. But again, I want to reiterate, when we've had these discussions in the Oregon Innovation Council and amongst our colleagues working on this, we did not want to do anything that would jeopardize the ability to get this thing going. But on the other hand, as you begin to think through the potential that exists with these funds, you begin to think, well, maybe we should consider the long-term benefit and allow these universities this source of capital to just continue rolling into the future. And so that's why we're bringing forward the Dash 4s for that consideration.
Paul, anything that we should know? We're in a work session on either the Dash 2 or the Dash 4s. And if someone has a BlackBerry or cell phone, and that's why our mics all do that.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of things about the revenue impact. As Senator Morse described, really the Dash 2s replace the bill. But one of the key elements of it is that if you look on the first reference there, line 2, it It deletes the reference to 315.521, which the original bill, I think this was inadvertent, actually changed the credit and increased it to from 60% to 100%. So that has been removed so that the credit now in the dash twos remains exactly as it was, as it is in current statute. So that's unaffected. So the revenue impact that we issued in 05 based on that statute remains in place. So in other words, this will have no impact on the revenue forecast, therefore no revenue impact for the dash twos. The dash fours do have a long run impact because we have assumed that, somewhere out there in the distance there would be a recapture of this 8.4 million in general fund dollars that have been used for the credit. If the dash fours are approved, then in effect those dollars become tied up in kind of this working capital fund that Senator Morse described and therefore would not be available for general purpose. However, we think that would be beyond our normal three biennia scoring. So it would be somewhere out there in probably the next decade or so. And of course, as you know, in description of these kind of research innovations, when they come to market and when they begin to pay off is very uncertain. And it could pay off very large in a short period of time, or it could be, you know, a very long period of time. So what we would do if you adopt the dash fours is we would issue a revenue impact statement saying this would be an impact out in the future, but we wouldn't put it in any of the three biennia that we currently score. It wouldn't be quantifiable in that period.
That's helpful. I view this as a technical. We've been holding off on credit bills in general so that we match them up with the budget. But that's helpful that the dash fours don't, the revenue impact statement would be just general, that there will be an impact, hopefully a positive one based on a lot of folks' predictions of the opportunities out there. So, committee, it's up to you. The dash twos perfect the bill and the program, and the dash fours lend some permanency to it.
Let's do the whole thing.
Great. I think everyone is all on the same page. Senator Morse, you have been at this for 2.5 years. So congratulations beforehand, and hopefully this will help a lot of not only our institutions but our economic growth in the state.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, colleagues. This has been a joy to work on with you and with others to think about how we can, in fact, jumpstart these great ideas that are emerging in our universities and will continue to emerge. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move dash two amendments right now since that replaces the bill. Dash two amendments to Senate Bill 582.
Senator George has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 582. Discussion. Objections.
And now I'll move the dash four amendments. We got up here, I believe we have an agreement on that, and that would, I think, be a very good move to make. So we'll move the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 582.
Senator George has moved the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 582. Discussion. Senator Monroe.
Deborah's back there from the department. Does she have any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Monroe, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse has mentioned the difficulty we had in interpreting the tax credit provisions. So with your leave, may I just put on the record what the Attorney General opinion was or advice was as to how that credit should be interpreted so it's there for legislative history?
Sure.
I will be very brief. The tax credit is equal to 60% of the amount contributed. During any given tax year, there are three limitations on the amount that the taxpayer can claim. The taxpayer can't take more than tax liability. They also cannot claim more than $50,000, and they cannot claim more than 20% of the amount contributed. The example given in the letter of advice is a contributor makes a $500,000 donation. The credit then is 60% of that amount, or $300,000. In any one year, they will be limited to $50,000 or $300,000, or tax liability, whichever is less. So as long as their liability is at least $50,000 in each of those years, they will be claiming that credit over 6 years. If their liability is less, they will spread out the period of time that they will take the credit. And that's how we will administer the credit, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Okay. That is helpful to get on
Thank
the
you.
Record.
Thank you.
We need our state agencies on these. I've heard that in the past. Having the Department of Revenue understand our intent is helpful on administering these tax credits, whether it's the business energy or this one. To make our intent is obviously to deliver some benefit to taxpayers and to Oregonians and to the causes they're hoping to benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you move the dashboards? any further discussion on the dashboards? Any objection to the dashboards? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 582 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 582 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections. So ordered. Senator Morse will carry that bill. Okay, so we will open a work session, close a work session on Senate Bill 582. Open a work session on Senate Bill 859. Chris, you have been working with, and Sasha, do you have a group that wants to walk us through with Chris? Chris is going to do it? Okay, Chris will walk us through the amendments to the charitable checkoff bill. Mac, you're fine though, Mac? Okay. Anyone else that wants to just wave at me, or we're just going to keep moving here? Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have in your packet there the dash two amendments. And I was just going to, there are seven or eight items there. And the changes that they make, the first one allows the Department of Revenue to list fewer than 12 entities if there is insufficient space on the return. The bill still wants at least 12 if possible. This just allows revenue the option if other space limitations are such that they could list fewer than 12.
Any questions? Maybe we'll do them one at a time since there was a number. Any questions on that? Okay.
The second item reduces the number of years that an entity would appear on the return from 3 to 2, and that's if all of the entities that are on the eligibility roster don't fit on the return. So that's just a minor change in the time that they would be on there. It helps the rotation.
And that one? Questions for that one? Okay.
The third one clarifies that an entity qualified for listing prior to January 1, 2007 does not have to collect signatures for qualification after January 1, 2007.
That's a good change. You got questions on? Okay.
Next, it clarifies that there are two other entity choices to be included on the return. So you'll have the up to 12, and then people can fill in up to two that from the list that will be in the instructions.
Okay.
It removes the dollar checkboxes that are on the return right now. There are checkboxes for $1, $5, or $10. This removes that and allows the space for the 12 charities.
Questions on that? Okay.
The changes apply.
Cinnamon Rao.
So instead there would just be a dollar sign and a blank, and you write in how many dollars you want to contribute?
That's correct, Senator.
Okay. Thank you.
The next one, the changes apply tax year 2007. That's the next year for which the department is there, or they will soon be, I believe, constructing the 2007 return. So that's the soonest the change could take place. And then the last piece as an emergency clause.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator George.
Yeah, that right there picks up those folks who are in the process of gathering the signatures. So
oh,
they
that's
can
right.
Stop that.
Yes.
Great.
That's right. Forgot about that. Yeah. Hopefully. We implore them as much as possible stop gathering those signatures. Questions for Chris. Deborah, do you want to come up and just let us know that this works for the department or doesn't, and get at Mr. Conkling's. He had a question about software that I believe, did not make that 7 changes. And I don't know if you can speak to that at all, or Chris, if you want to.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, we're fine with the amendments. We did ask staff to look at the possibility of, at least with electronic filing, showing all of the entities, encouraging software companies to do that. The difficulty that they reported back to me is that we follow national standards that require that the electronic version of a return be exactly the same as a printed version of the return, and to diverge from that might cost us some electronic filing. Some companies might just decide not to offer Oregon as an option. But I will commit to you that we will look at our forms design and see if there is another way to get to that. One thing that we are considering and will investigate is actually making a schedule of the instruction listing entities that would be considered a part of the return but wouldn't be filed with the return. So that's one thing we might be able to look at. There are other areas that we can consider to try to get to that concern and try to make it appear that all of them are at least available in some manner. So we will do that even though the bill does not instruct us to do so.
That's great. That's great. Obviously more Oregonians are using the electronics so they could see all these charities would be helpful. Questions for Chris or for Deborah, beginning with the department?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 859.
Senator George has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 859 discussion. Objections to that motion? Ordered.
And now 859 as amended to the floor of the due pass.
Let me make sure no one waved. Any waves that would like to
comment?
Can you restate?
Okay. Move Senate Bill 859 as amended with dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved 859 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections to that motion? So ordered. Senator George, would you like to carry that bill? I seem to have enthusiasm for it.
Mr. Chairman, it's really interesting. This morning I was on the radio, and the talk show person said, well, what kind of really positive things are going down there? I wish I'd have had these two bills to talk about this morning, because, you know, these are things that may not seem big to somebody, but to a lot of folks, this is a real positive step.
Yeah.
Appreciate the bills.
Yeah. No, and thank you to Sasha and to Mac and all the charities who worked really hard. This should hopefully be beneficial to all, even the General Caldwell. We hope even to those who are coming onto the forum too. We hope that it lifts all the boats for a lot of nonprofits. So thank you for all the work, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 859. And now we'll open a public hearing on our assessor bills, and that usually clears the room like no other. So I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 814 and Senate Bill 815. Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 814 permits an assessor or tax roll officer to correct errors in value at any time if the correction results in a reduced tax. Under current law, this can only be done before December 31st. And obviously, when this is the case and a tax is being appealed in the court, property tax appeals court, the tax that's in dispute is subject to a refund. And if, of course, the appeal favors the taxpayer, the refund accrues at 12% annual interest, and some of these appeals can be extended for multiple years. So there is definite positive benefit to allowing the tax assessor or a tax roll officer to reduce an error in value if they notice it during the appeal process. It will reduce the amount of refund that's due. There is an amendment that came forth this morning, which I understand has been reviewed with the Department of Revenue staff. And it basically, I believe it just really adds something to it. It allows the department to be involved in this reduction, especially if the area that's in dispute is centrally assessed. I think that's the gist of it, but the department can qualify that. There's been no disagreement as to the intent of this bill.
I have put together a revenue impact statement very quickly this morning, having understood the purpose of the bill. And I do know that it's really virtually impossible to put an exact, precise number on this, except because it's not indeterminate. It's certainly, in some cases, more than $50,000. In one instance, one tax case involved a reduction. It saved the state $100,000 in refunds. So I just simply said it really depends on the value that's being reduced and the length of the appeal process.
Great. Questions for Mary on Senate Bill 814 or 815? Okay. Randy Walra and John, do you want to come up with him? And Gary, are you? You're good. Gail, do you want to be up on this? Okay. It's your show.
Yeah, Gary.
There's one more chair if anyone wants it. Right. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Decker,
members of the committee, for the record, I am Randy Walworth, assessor for Multnomah County. I'm here today in regards to Senate Bill 814, which is a Multnomah County proposal for revision to SB 11205. Basically, Mary cut right to the core on this. It would allow us, after December 31st, to make reductions on accounts that are under appeal at the tax court, in which we've determined that the valuation is too high and that a refund is in order. Under current statutes, we cannot make those refunds until the case is settled and a magistrate or the tax court has issued their final order. We have situations where our appraiser determines that the value was too high. We do not agree with the taxpayer, so we're not able to settle the case at that point. But what we would like to do is be able to issue the refund and stop the interest and put the money back in the taxpayer's hands. So this is a situation where the taxpayer has come forward and said, our value is too high, I've been overtaxed. We're agreeing, but not to the degree that they're claiming. So many times these cases can take, in certain circumstances, 5 years, 6 years to settle due to various litigation issues and interpretation of the statutes. So that's the quick on that, and I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Question? Yeah. Senator Burdick.
Thank you. So if you agree that they've been overtaxed but not as much as they think,
yes,
then what is the recourse of the taxpayer? Is this a settlement process that the taxpayer settles for this amount, or do they continue with the appeal?
They continue with the appeal. Basically, once we typically come up with a valuation that's lower than the current roll, we offer that as a stipulation to the taxpayer. They give consideration to that. They may accept the stipulated offer, and then the case is settled and the refunds are issued. But there's other situations where the taxpayer believes that our offer is not low enough, and they believe that their evidence will support a lower value at the tax court level. So they basically reject our offer and move forward. This bill would allow us to make that interim refund down to the level that we've now determined.
And who pays for the continued appeal? Does the taxpayer have to pay to continue the appeal? Or?
They appeal. They pay for their counsel, and we pay for ours. Okay. Yes.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, if this is what I think it is, it's a really good idea, because I have one of my counties has just suffered greatly because of some rightfully reduced evaluations. But the devastating impact is paying that interest at 12.5%, you said. And this would allow you to then bring their level back down to something reasonable, hopefully as an offer they might accept. But if nothing else, then you've reduced their taxes, and the interest that you're going to pay is going to be based on that lower number. Is that kind of what you're aiming at?
That's correct. And it'll allow us to reduce, hopefully, future rolls, too, as we're fighting, so to speak, fighting this out, so that we do not continue with a higher level of assessment than would be appropriate.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is fair to everyone. I think it's a great idea.
Just makes sense.
Yeah. Other questions? John, anything to add?
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue.
Senate Bill 814, I think, recognizes the interdependence of the taxpayer and the tax system. And right now, the way the system is constructed, it tends to limit the abilities of the parties to resolve conflicts outside of litigation. It's incumbent upon the assessors and the department to determine assessed value or market value, based on what we know and have information of the account and the property. And as we move toward, from the date that the properties are assessed and the bills are sent out, from then on, additional information can come in either through litigation or through discussions or conversations. And then really it should be at the option of the assessor or the department to reduce the value or suggest any, in this case, we're strictly talking about reductions to the correct market value, because that's really what we're after. And if the system prevents that, then this bill will address that situation, I believe.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Burke.
Is there anything in this bill that would encourage you to, just for the sake of avoiding a hassle, to lower the value when it really wasn't justified?
I think this bill can actually have the opposite effect. I think that there's times where, due to the interest situation and the litigation risk, assessors may possibly be reducing values when they may not otherwise want to levels in order to settle the case. So you're more inclined to, I think under the current system, there's pressure to lower values to perhaps values you would not in order to settle the case, so you can stop the interest as you fight out the legal issues. So I think the opposite effect is what's going to happen here.
Good point.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 815 is a proposed revision that clarifies what we believe is an oversight in the statutes to make clear on a transfer of a property from an exempt status to a taxable status between January 1st and June 30th of the assessment year. Prior to 1991, the language was clear in the statutes, and in 1991, when we merged under Measure 5 to a July 1st date, some of that language was no longer necessary because we eliminated the January 1st assessment date and everything was based on July 1st. When we returned to a January 1st date with subsequent statutes, language was put back in clarifying going from taxable to non-taxable, but the same language and was not put back in regarding this status of going from an exempt to a taxable status. We believe that this is to clarify and make more clear current practice. We've looked at these statutes and reviewing statutes with my county attorney. He recommended that we needed to clarify this language and make it clear what present practice is.
John,
Mr. Chair, I don't have anything to add unless there are questions.
Questions for the panel on 815. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 814 and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 815. Open a work session on Senate Bill 814.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 814.
Senator George has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 814. Discussion. Objections.
And then move Senate Bill 814 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 814 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections. Senator George, you want to have enthusiasm for that one also?
Oh, yeah. Maybe it's the coffee. I've had coffee. these are good bills. I really appreciate it.
Folks, see any reason that we ought to hold on to 815? Open a work session on Senate Bill 815.
Mr. Chairman, move Senate Bill 815 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And if I could assign this one, I might drink any more coffee than the other five.
I'll let someone, hopefully someone will volunteer on this. Discussion on Senate Bill 815. Objections to Senate Bill 815. So ordered. Senator George will not be carrying Senate Bill 815. Who would like to carry? Star's not looking at me. Burdick's not looking at me. Monroe is. Senator Monroe will carry that Senate Bill 815, and we are done until Monday at 8:45. As part of the legislature goes on this rural tour to the southern coast and Roseburg and where else in Houston Star, all over. We're adjourned until Monday at 8:45.